what I realized was that a lot of humans aren't very empathetic. Like, they actually struggle to be empathetic. And so what I realized was that AI may actually enhance human empathy by synthesizing it for people. Welcome to the Artificial Intelligence Show, the podcast that helps your business grow smarter by making AI approachable and actionable. My name is Paul Raitzer. I'm the founder and CEO of Marketing AI Institute, and I'm your host. Each week, I'm joined by my co-host and Marketing AI Institute Chief Content Officer, Mike DePut, as we break down all the AI news that matters and give you insights and perspectives that you can use to advance your company and your career. Join us as we accelerate AI literacy for all. Welcome to episode 90 of the Artificial Intelligence Show. I'm your host, Paul Raitzer, along with my co-host, Mike Caput. We are coming to you on, we're recording this on Friday, March 29th. It is a morning edition on Friday, March 29th. So again, we're doing this a day early this week. We usually record on Mondays, but it is spring break for some of us. So I am heading out. And so we're squeezing this one in before we go. And we had a lot of tools this week, I would say. Last week's episode was all about like large language model platforms. I feel like this week there's a whole bunch of interesting tool, AI tool news. So we're going to get into a lot of that. Speaking of AI tools, our episode today is brought to us by Rasa.io. It is the ultimate platform for AI-powered newsletters. If you're looking to transform your email newsletter into a powerful, engaging tool that truly resonates with your audiences, Rasa.io is the game changer you need. Their smart newsletter platform personalizes content for each and every subscriber, ensuring every message you send is highly relevant and incredibly engaging. The tool also allows you to automate away the tedious tasks that go into newsletter production, stay ahead of the curve, and make your emails a must-read. Join the 500-plus organizations already making their newsletter smart. Visit rasa.io/maii today. MAII is Marketing AI Institute. So rasa.io/maii today. Okay, Mike, let's get started with our AI tools of the week.
All right, Paul. So first up, an AI startup called Hume AI has just started turning some heads with a pretty impressive demo of some stunning new and potentially creepy AI technology. Now, this startup is co-founded by a former Google DeepMind researcher, and their core product is something called its Empathetic Voice Interface, or EVI. EVI can carry on a conversation with you simply by speaking and responding via voice chat. But that's not really what has everyone paying attention to this. When you converse with EVI, the system actually understands your emotions, so it can react to those emotions with language that addresses your needs in the tone that addresses your needs. So that means EVI can do things like understand your pitch, your tone, your facial expression in order to conduct a more emotionally intelligent conversation with you. So Hume AI said in an announcement, EVI has a number of unique empathetic capabilities. It responds with human-like tones of voice based on your expressions. It reacts to your expressions with language that addresses your needs and maximizes satisfaction. EVI knows when to speak because it uses your tone of voice for state-of-the-art end-of-turn detection. It stops when interrupted, but can always pick up where it left off. And it learns to make you happy by applying your reactions to self-improve over time. So the company released both a video demo and a self-serve one. You can go try the tool out for yourself. And at the same time, Hume AI also announced it had raised $50 million in Series B funding. So Paul, I played around with this a little bit and it seemed pretty impressive, but I can already hear the internet comments explode with some strong opinions on this type of technology. Like, did you find this cool, creepy, a little bit of both?
My first reaction was that I was kind of surprised this was the first real demo we're seeing of this. Like, it seemed like such an obvious thing that would come that when I first saw it, I was like, is this really the first time we're seeing this? Because this is, and we've talked about empathy on the show before, and my my thought is that this is really interesting. It is definitely potentially creepy, but I think we have to take a step back and think about the role of empathy in like human communications. And years ago, when I was first starting to really think about the things that I thought remained uniquely human as AI became more intelligent, more advanced, I always had empathy on the list. And then there was a point a few years back where I realized that probably wasn't going to be the case. And we've talked about this, it was probably 20, 30 episodes ago. I don't remember what the tool was we were talking about at the time. But what I realized was that a lot of humans aren't very empathetic, like they actually struggle to be empathetic. And so while it is sort of a unique human trait, there are many humans who don't have that trait, or it's not a very strong trait of theirs. But it's so important in communications and relationships to have empathy. And so what I realized was that AI may actually enhance human empathy by synthesizing it for people. So like if what I mean by that is if someone who isn't normally very empathetic and struggles to relate to and convey with other people actually writes something and then tells the AI, make this more empathetic, the AI can do that every time. Well, that's what it was. We were talking episode last year about a test that was run for doctors where the patients found the communications with the AI more empathetic. And what you realize is like, wow, okay, a lot of doctors probably struggle to make those connections with people and to be empathetic toward them. So while I think it's a little bit unnerving that technology like this exists, I do choose to kind of see the positive side in that I think more empathy in society is always good. And if some people need to rely on their AI assistant to help them be that way, so be it. I think that can be a good thing. I also see it having a lot of positive impact within business. So, you know, I always want to try and like connect this back to how do we use this in business? So if you think about like HR, you know, when you have to communicate bad news from an HR perspective, there's a lot of people probably aren't very good at that. So to be able to put that through an empathy layer, basically, you know, always making things more empathetic. Think about customer service, you know, and understanding, you know, what people are going through. Think about patient communications we just talked about. Marketing, sales, like all of these things, empathy is able to enrich the communications and the relationships that occur. And so I think what happens is this is, again, since it's not prevalent already, I can't imagine a near future, 1 to 2 years out, where every AI chatbot doesn't have an empathy component to it. Both be understanding your emotions as you're communicating with it, but then able to communicate back to you in an empathetic way. So I think this is probably the very early. You could certainly imagine Siri, you know, by fall of this year, actually understanding the tone of your voice and not just communicating to all of us in the same way, but communicating based on how you're feeling, how you're acting, you know, how your voice sounds. And certainly we've talked a lot in the last few episodes about robotics. You could imagine, you know, humanoid robots going to a whole different level if, you know, they're embodied with not only intelligence, but empathy. So I do still feel that empathy is a uniquely human trait. The machine doesn't actually feel anything, but it can synthesize empathy at a superhuman level. And that's a weird thing to wrap our minds around, but I think that's just a fact. Like it's going to be able to be empathetic or synthesize empathy in all modalities. And that's going to be something we're just going to have to adjust to as a society. But again, I think I generally choose to view this as a positive if it's applied in the right ways.
Yeah, I would agree. And it's worth mentioning to your point about use cases and seeing this stuff everywhere that while you can play with the personal AI assistant on their website, the big focus here is the Eevee API itself, which they're encouraging others to build on top and bake into basically any application you could think of. So that can be very positive from that sense as well.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, Mike. And also a reminder, like you don't have to wait for access to this to use AI tools to help you be more empathetic. You can use it in ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, whatever you're using. When you're writing something, ask it to make it more empathetic and it'll do it. Like you can do this right now. I've seen people use this for like, you know, customer communications and patient communication. So yeah, use the AI to help you with empathy. Like I think that's a valuable use case for it. Like I said at the start, we need more empathy in society. And if we learn to be more empathetic through the machines, great.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I find myself more and more using it in that respect of saying, well, now I've got this 24/7 assistant that's not going to judge me, that I'm not going to feel embarrassed talking to somebody about, and that has all these capabilities. I find myself saying, well, what do you think of the tone of this email or this communication? I can sometimes be a little too blunt when I don't mean to be. Like, how might this be perceived, or how could I better understand what this person might be going through?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to assume these models in the not too distant future will automatically detect that sort of thing. Mm. So, you know, let's say you go in and you need to, you know, lay some people off, and you draft a letter in ChatGPT where you're doing layoffs. It would detect that there's a negative connotation to the content and recommend a more empathetic approach to it. You know, that's the kind of thing, again, I think, as these things become true assistants, and like you're saying, like always there 24/7, it's not just reactive to us asking for more empathy, but it's actually proactive by assessing what's being created and how the tools are being used, and actually bringing that kind of value to it, saying, hey, based on the tone of this, you may want to consider it to be more empathetic. Here's a version of it that you could, you know, take a look at. And I think that's, again, like the sort of the positive outlook of what co-pilots or assistants can be, is that they're proactive in helping us be better professionals also.
All right. So this next one is a little crazy as well. So we just got a sneak peek at kind of one potential future pathway of journalism in the age of AI. So we've actually been playing around with a new AI tool called AI Journalist from our friends at HyperWrite. And this is an AI driven research and writing tool that generates articles basically on any topic you give it. But what's interesting is that when you give it a topic, it goes and searches the internet for articles and real-time details about the topic. It actually looks at and starts to try to evaluate and pick the best sources and understand them. And then it actually writes you an in-depth article based on what it finds. And using the tool, it will actually automatically hyperlink all the sources that it's been using right in the article itself. So what you get in just a few seconds is an article with at least its attempt at factual information and real-time sourcing that looks and sounds honestly like something written by Reuters or the Associated Press. And this kind of comes amidst some other discussions we've been having on this podcast about some high profile efforts to kind of reinvent journalism or rethink it with AI. And one that's also on the radar that we heard about again this week is Google's generative AI news product. So this is something we talked about on a previous episode that it's reportedly testing with a very small group of news outlets. And we saw a report from Alex Kantrowitz in Big Technology, where he kind of dived deeper into this because he was very interested in how this tool or purported Gen AI initiative would impact journalism. The way he described this was, a journalist first selects a seed source using Google's tool that they're piloting, like a city council, a parks department, a local school, something they plan to cover. And then with a link from that single source, whether that's a press release, a 500-page report, a tweet, Google's generative AI software produces a first draft of the story, complete with a lead, a nut graph, quotes, and the rest. And the vision is to eventually allow for multiple input sources. So this idea is that a journalist can then add to that draft with their reporting, their fact-checking, and eventually publish a full story. So these are two separate tools and initiatives, but both appearing to kind of do the same thing, which is augment the work of journalism using artificial intelligence. Now, Paul, we both have backgrounds in journalism. Like, HyperWrite's AI journalist tool, I'll be honest, blew me away. Pretty, pretty interesting. Are human journalists in trouble due to these tools?
I think you can take that perspective. For sure. Like, I mean, you can look at this and experiment with it and realize it's pretty good, and it's It's obviously pretty raw. And if I'm not mistaken, Matt built this in like a day or over a weekend through Claude Opus API. So this is just like a V1, not even probably. It's just an alpha basically of the concept. And it's available. We'll put the link in the notes, but like you can go try it out for free, I believe, Mike, right? Like you
With HyperWrite. So they did two pathways here. Matt built an open source version. So if you are familiar with how to run that yourself, you can basically just connect your API key for Claude to the tool and run everything on your own. But there's an easier to use version that I think most people would probably find easier to adopt, which is on HyperWrite's website. So you can use that, try that out for free. They give you like credits based on your usage.
Okay. So couple of just thinking out loud here. One, we still have to deal with the fact that if you want to own the content, you don't if AI writes it. So if you're a media outlet, if we're talking about impact on journalism, this doesn't change the fact that US copyright law mandates that a human has to create something to get a copyright. And I don't know of a publishing outlet that wouldn't want the copyright on their material. So I don't see this as all of a sudden journalists are just going to start using this tool or media companies will start using this and put journalists out of work. That's not viable. Second thing that comes to mind is great journalism is sourced, like where you go do the work, you talk to people, you do interviews. So all this tool is doing is going and pulling from existing third-party content and sources. There's no first-party stuff. There's no finding that source and getting the great story. Like, you and I love The Information as an example.
Right.
The Information pumps out great stories because they're sourced within these tech companies and they get, they break stories that you're not going to find on the internet. So it's not replacing that kind of journalism. Like you and I talked about this the first day we saw it, Mike, and the couple things that jumped out to me was the massive potential value for internal documents and processes. So like we were on a call last week and something came up, or it was on Monday, and it was a new program that I wanted to kind of research. And so I mentioned on the call. And so Mike, like in real time, goes and like tests this thing out and so like write me an article about this program, and it does. And now we have to verify the facts of it, but it just literally saved us like an hour probably of doing research and writing a brief, which is something we do all the time internally, just write briefs on topics and people and ideas. And it just wrote it and it sourced it and like gave the links to it. So my immediate thought was, wow, this could really be valuable within internal processes and documents that we don't need a copyright on that are never going to see the time of day. I could see it from a journalist perspective, if we want to stay on that line of thinking, journalists and writers, that you could use it to get stories started and then layer in the interviews and like the original research and reporting that goes into these stories. But I also thought about the decimation of local media. So again, as people with backgrounds in journalism and the media industry, for years, we've been watching this industry just get crushed, and it had nothing to do with AI. This is what you and I have talked about this many times, Mike. All the loss of journalists, like, you know, I think I shared the story when my dad, worked for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And so he delivered papers for like, you know, 15, 17 years. And then he was a manager of a depot for a number of years. And when my dad used to like take me into the press room at downtown Cleveland, like when I was a kid, we would go in and like still smell like the ink of the presses. There was hundreds of journalists in the Plain Dealer newsroom. Now there's like, I don't know, 20, 30. So like that whole industry has just gotten wiped out because of their reliance on advertising. Like classified ads used to be like what made these local media outlets go. And then classifieds, obviously, everything just kind of went online. They had to find like a next thing. So they've gotten crushed because of their ad supported model. And so you and I, Mike, for years have known this has nothing to do with AI yet. What happens when AI comes for this industry? And I think we're here. Like, you know, for years, I've been talking to journalism schools and heads of these communication schools and saying like, hey, it's going to come. There's going to be a day where this thing does what we're teaching these students to do. And I think we've arrived at that. But the positive potential is society needs local journalism. Like, we want to know the local sports stories. We want to know what's going on with local government. We want to be informed citizens. And because the business model doesn't support that happening anymore, we have communities that have no verifiable information coming other than like Facebook boards and stuff like that. So my, again, positive perspective on this is, what if we can use these tools to fill the gaps in local news? What if a future newsroom is an editor or two that works with the AI to write the stories of what's going on in the community and, you know, curates like the reliable sources to like source those stories. And then the editor does what editors do, which verify facts, like make sure the information is reliable. And so I can actually imagine a scenario where local media reemerges in an entirely different, much more streamlined model and doesn't replace jobs or eliminate writers. It may actually create new writing and editing jobs where the AI and the human are working in tandem. And and that to me is the possibility of all of this. We can get stuck on the negative and be like, oh, it's just going to replace everybody. But like, what if? Like, what if we just think about reinventing that industry, reinventing local media, expanding, you know, the stories that are being told through reliable sources in your industry? You know, trade magazines are the same thing. Like, we came up in B2B marketing, Mike, at the agency. And like those trade magazines are completely dependent upon advertising dollars. And so you have all of these trade pubs that are at risk of going away just because of the ad model, not because of AI. Well, maybe AI is the answer there too. So again, I don't want to be like, pretend like there aren't negatives here, but I think that if you step back, there's a chance to kind of reimagine that whole industry and using these as true tools to accelerate that.
Yeah, I tend to agree on that. I think that there's a massive unexplored opportunity here, which will be interesting to see play out. And kind of one final note, even if you zoom out a little further and just say, what does this do for your ability to research anything? You mentioned internal briefs and documents. And to me, this is all upside. I try to tell people, I get geeked out about it. I'm like, do you realize you have research superpowers now? It's really cool. And yeah. To your point about the example of the topic we were looking up during a meeting, like that just saved us a bunch of time that we then used in other ways and told us, gave us the ability to answer a question that was really important to our business. Now we can do that over and over and over again.
Yeah. And the other thing that, you know, I thought of this week was, you know, we talked about in last week's episode about how you can't make your plans based on what these models are capable of today. And the one big thing that people always, you know, talk about with large language models is the hallucinations or the fact they make stuff up, that there's a, you know, a higher error rate. The indications are that that's going to go away. And so there's a paper we'll talk more in depth about next week, but DeepMind, Google DeepMind just published a paper this week called, let me see if I have it, Long Form Factuality and Large Language Models. It was a collaboration between Stanford University and Google DeepMind. And Ethan Mollick actually tweeted this and summarized like three quick points, and then we'll just kind of leave it here. We'll come back to this next week. Large language model agents can achieve superhuman rating performance on fact-checking when given access to Google. So if you mix search in, AI can actually be more reliable than humans at reporting facts. The second point was bigger models are more factual, which is exactly what we said last week. As you get to GPT-5, Gemini 2, the bigger these models get, it just sort of seems to solve for the reliability and factuality of the content. And third, large language models are 20 times cheaper than humans. So Google DeepMind's own research is basically saying, we're going to solve for this hallucination issue. These things are going to become more factual and reliable. And so you're going to be able to rely on them more in newsrooms and publishing outlets and media outlets, and even on brands, like as you're telling stories and doing research. So yeah, I mean, I think the AI journalist thing is really interesting, but I think it in a more macro level, it just is an indicator of where this is all going and how we're going to become more and more reliant on these tools as an integral part of our workflows, whether you're in HR, finance, research, product sales, doesn't matter.
All right. So in our third big topic today, Claude 3 Opus, the most powerful version of the new Claude 3 family of models, has just dethroned GPT-4 as the most powerful language model out there, according to one of the major leaderboards. Now, the website leaderboard we're talking about is called lmsys.org, aka the Large Model Systems Organization. And this is a group that we've mentioned a couple times that evaluates large language models through a section on their website called their Chatbot Arena. Now, the Chatbot Arena uses crowdsourcing and ELO ratings, which are a popular way to evaluate how skilled people are at zero-sum games. They use it in chess a lot. And they use this methodology to rate the capabilities of large language models. So this leaderboard is one of the trusted industry sources of which models are most capable and powerful in any given moment. And as of us recording this on Friday around 9:10 a.m. Eastern, Claude 3 Opus now sits at the very top, just slightly beating out one version of GPT-4 that had previously been number one. Now, this is just one set of rankings, and the rankings change constantly. But that's actually the point here, and why I think this is important to talk about, is that Claude 3 Opus like came out this month and very quickly started to displace other very, very powerful models. And it quickly displayed incredible capabilities that you could that could enable and empower you with certain use cases and workflows you might not have been able to totally dial in before. So, Paul, can you walk us through, like, how do you think about all these different models and like how fast things change and how to bet on singular models?
I don't know how you it is so fast moving. So I've been testing Claude 3 Opus through Perplexity. So I have like the Perplexity paid plan, and you can choose which model you use. So I'll kind of bounce around and test the different ones. But I did finally just start paying directly for the Claude license. So I think it just shows how dynamic this space is. As you mentioned, like new models every week. There's a couple other models I think we're going to talk about in the rapid fire items. Like, this is not the only news of the week of movement on the leaderboard. But the one thing that keeps coming back to me is everybody keeps talking about like beating GPT-4 and like this monumental thing that they're now ahead of GPT-4. GPT-4 came out in March of 2023, a year ago. It was training stopped 6 months before it came out. So everyone is now beating a model that is like 18 months old. Mm. OpenAI has not stopped building and training a more powerful model. So if all of these companies are just catching up to GPT-4 and in some evaluations, just beating them out slightly on different evaluations, what in the world is GPT-5 going to look like? Like, it's just the thing that I keep coming back to, and we keep talking about how you can't get comfortable with the current technology. Is like Claude 3 is amazing. Like, yeah. Our early testing is really impressive. You talked about some of your experiences with it last week. But it's being compared to an 18-month-old model. And so, like, I got an email yesterday. I got to go check and see where the details are. But it said that DALL-E 3 is now going to have editing ability. Like, you're going to be able to edit images within ChatGPT. So I think, as Sam talked about in Lex Friedman podcast, they're just going to, like, gradually introduce a bunch of capabilities that collectively may be a part of the GPT-5 story or whatever they end up calling the next version. And so that, like, definitely play with Claude, pay the $20 a month if you need to and just experiment with it. But it keeps building up my anticipation for what GPT-5 and Gemini 2 are going to be. And then I don't know, Mike, for you, but I thought it'd be interesting to note for people. So I actually, in Chrome, I have an AI tools group saved.
Yep.
And so my current browser that has that, I have Runway. These are all the licenses I'm paying for that I have up all the time that I've just bounced in and test depending on what it is. So I have Runway going, which I have for video and images. I have now my Claude license active. I have ChatGPT team, and we have both a workspace and I still have the personal one. We have Google Gemini. I have Perplexity. Playground.ai I love for images. I have the leaderboard, the chat arena you just mentioned, and then I now have Google AI Studio up where I can test Gemini 1.5 Pro. So if anyone's ever, like, people always ask me, like, what tools do you use every day? those are the 2, 4, 6, 8 tabs that I have active all day long that I may jump in at any time. What about you? Do you have any other ones that you keep active all day long? That you're
those are my stack that I go to daily is very, very similar, okay. I would say. I think that's worth noting, like all the paid versions of the major assistants, so Gemini Advanced, Claude 3, ChatGPT, Team Plus, whatever, right. Just so you can get the most powerful version of this stuff. I think Gemini 1.5 you mentioned is always open as well, just based on how interesting some of the capabilities are with the context window. I'd say honestly, just on top of that, Hemingway, Grammarly, just because okay. I'm writing a lot, but yeah, very similar stack. But you'd be so shocked how game-changing even that stack can be if you're keeping this open and using it for all these things in your life.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's dive into some rapid fire. So big first rapid fire item is that hot on the heels of last week's story that we reported, where 3 out of 5 of Stability AI's top researchers resigned from the company. We have another resignation. The company's CEO, Ahmad Mostak, has also now resigned. The company has appointed their chief operating officer and their chief technology officer as co-CEOs in his absence. So the company said Mostak stepped down to pursue, quote, decentralized AI. And Mostak appeared to confirm that in a separate post on X. He said, quote, not going to beat centralized AI with more centralized AI. All in on decentralized AI. Lots more soon. Now, by decentralized AI, it appears he's broadly referring to an approach to AI development where computation, decision-making, it's all distributed across a network of devices, not essentially centralized in a single set of servers owned by a single company. So Paul, given your knowledge of Stability AI and Mostak's kind of background and history, like what was your read on this situation?
It just seemed inevitable. I mean, obviously, if you listen to last week's episode, I shared some of my perspective on this company as a whole. There's probably a dad joke in here somewhere about renaming the company Instability AI. That would make my daughter cringe. But I mean, the fact that I don't know how they phrased it, that he left or resigned. I think resigned is probably a generous term here, given everything that had happened. So I don't know, like we'll see where they go from here. The decentralized AI thing, it just, I don't know, like, I get it. Like, I think it's an important thing. It just seems like a quick sleight of hand to like, hey, look at this. Let's forget about the fact that we just blew through $100 million in funding and don't have a business model that's viable, and let's go talk about something else. So we'll see where he goes, see what he does. He posted a tweet where he was having a Teams meeting with Satya Nadella, you know, bragging about that. So we'll see where that goes. Satya's sort of like collecting all the pieces, it seems.
Yeah, no kidding.
So again, like I follow him on Twitter. He shares a lot of interesting stuff. He's patched into a lot of people. He generally he likes to tweet ahead of time to let you know he knows things. So he's a pretty good one to know when new models are coming, because he'll tell you he knows new models are coming. So I follow him. I hope he does good things, but not shocking at all that this is how it ended at Stability.
All right, so next up, HeyGen, which is a leading AI startup that is for creating synthetic voices and videos, just raised $60 million at a $440 million valuation. They have drawn a ton of attention for hyper-realistic AI-generated videos. So these have extremely lifelike virtual avatars, or you can make these pretty stunning deepfakes of real people and have them say whatever you want. Now, at the same time they announced this funding, they also released a new feature called Avatar in Motion 1.0, which we have a video linked to in the notes here. It's worth taking a look at. Now, according to HeyGen, this feature allows you to, quote, move your hands, make gestures, use unique tones of voice, and HeyGen will flawlessly track translate and lip sync your video with any input text. So, Paul, there seem to be quite a few ways this technology can benefit companies, plenty of ways it can go wrong. Some of this stuff is just increasingly pretty stunning. What are your thoughts on HeyGen and kind of the overall trend here of what they're trying to do?
So I went to their site to try and like see this, and there was nothing there. The only thing I could find was this tweet, but they did tweet again last night. Wow, this blew up. Should we release a demo to the public? Comment if you want access. And then they replied, said, okay, the people have spoken. We'll try and whip up a demo tonight, which would have been Thursday night, March 28th, that you can use tomorrow, which would have been Friday, March 29th. So by the time you're listening to this, there is likely a further demo of this technology on the HeyGen site or on the HeyGen X/Twitter account. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely moving us further and further down the path of you don't know what's real. And that is a very scary premise for society. But I mean, just the quick demo they showed, I mean, you would have to really, really study that to not know it's fake. So the fact that the guy's walking through the park and, you know, gesturing hands, like everything just looks legit. So yeah, I think that's it. Fascinating tech. Absolutely. Certainly imagine a bunch of practical business cases for this. You're certainly going to see this used in marketing and sales stuff, whether people disclose it or not. I have no idea. This probably gets back to the importance of having generative AI policies for your company that states when you're allowed to use this kind of technology, whether or not you disclose it to people that you are using it. So I think it brings us back to the importance of having those policies within your organization. And then also just making sure that if you choose to use this technology, you very clearly understand their terms of use. Like, what are you giving them the rights to once you create a deepfake of yourself on their technology? And we saw this again with like Inflection last week, this lesson of you have to trust these companies that you're giving this information to or letting them create these deepfakes, because what if HeyGen is the next one that crumbles and somebody, you know, scoops up the technology? Or who are the investors in HeyGen? Like all these things that you don't really think about, because you just think, wow, this is really cool tech. I'm going to go deepfake myself. And then all of a sudden you're wishing you hadn't given that intellectual property to somebody else. So again, just kind of like the cautionary tale of make sure you check the terms of use. If it's from a business perspective, make sure legal is involved in assessing this before you go deep faking people in your company without their knowledge or deep faking yourself. It's just where we're going to be with all of this stuff, from audio to video to images. You got to be aware of how this stuff works and who you're giving this information to, because this is the one I see all the time. Every conference I go to, people are, you know, HeyGen, you know, deep fakes of themselves. I have not done it yet. No. I don't know if you've tried it yet, Mike.
No, but I haven't done it yet.
But I haven't done it for that exact reason. Yeah. Like, I don't understand their terms. I don't know who I'm giving my information to and where it could go from there if HeyGen changes hands and now all of a sudden I've passed on my permissions to whomever acquires them or buys them or whatever.
Yeah, and we've belabored this point quite a bit on this podcast, but also just understanding that from my understanding of reading HeyGen's website, any of these sites, they need a couple minutes of footage of you. So I'm not saying people should be paranoid all the time, but like there's enough footage of you probably on the internet to be able to do this. So it's probably good to start acting accordingly in your own business. Things like contracts, the usage of your likeness, things like that are probably going to become quite a bit more important than they used to be.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for your communications team, legal team, you probably need to, you know, be monitoring for deepfakes of executives and things like that, board members. Again, this isn't meant to be fear stuff. This is the reality of where we are. Like, it's not hard to deepfake anybody without their permission. So, I mean, your communications team, whoever does your media monitoring and social media monitoring, they need to be monitoring for deepfakes of key people within your organization.
All right. So next up, Databricks, which is a popular data intelligence platform. They just released a new open source foundation model called DBRX. And they say it, quote, outperforms all established open models in quality benchmarks and allows you to quickly build your own custom LLM on your data. What appears to be noteworthy about this model is that DBRX beat says it beats at least Meta's Llama 2, Grok, and Mistral on language understanding, programming, math, and logic tasks. And it says it beats GPT 3.5 on most benchmarks. Now, on that last bit, this is the important part. Databricks says, quote, "This is important as we have seen a major behavioral shift in the last quarter among our 12,000 plus customer base. Enterprises and organizations are increasingly replacing proprietary models with open source models for better efficiency and control. In our experience, many customers can outperform the quality and speed of proprietary models by customizing open source models on their specific tasks." So, Paul, this relates to a topic we talked about last week about how enterprises are embracing multiple models to achieve their goals, including open source ones. So when you read about something like this, like, how are you thinking about the advent of these new powerful open source models for enterprises?
Well, I mean, two things immediately come to my mind. One, there's probably going to have to be a role within enterprises that is exclusively focused on this stuff. Like, I mean, the more I think about it, so I think chief AI officer is going to be, you know, an emerging role in enterprises. You know, we're already starting to see that. But you could start to see the formation of an org chart underneath that. And I could see managing like the symphony of large language models as a full-time role or multiple people working on this. Like you might have like someone who's focused on the open source stack, someone who's focused on the proprietary tools. So who figures this out is basically what I'm saying. Like we have talked to a lot of very big enterprises and I have yet to find one that has someone who solves for this. It is like falling to the CTO, CIO, chief digital officer in some cases, but they have no training and background in how to do this. So I feel like this is an emerging role. The complexity of these choices is becoming so great that it is not something you're going to get out of a weekly podcast. Like me and you, Mike, are not going to like be able to give the recommendation to people of what you do with as dynamic and complex as this space is becoming. So one, I think internal structure is going to start having people dedicated to this. And two, outside consulting companies are like have to do this. Like, and I know people like McKinsey and Accenture and Deloitte and people like that are doing this, but it's moving so fast. So that's the thing is like, if this is overwhelming to you, if like, what? There's like another open source model and it's now beating this. I thought last week you guys said this. Yeah, exactly. Like it's moving so fast that you don't even have time to get in and test these things and like play around with them. So I think that's my main takeaway is, again, just shows how fast this is accelerating and the need to start getting people in place who focus on this stuff. It's really hard to keep up with. So if you're feeling overwhelmed, join the club. It's tricky right now. And it's only going to get crazier.
All right, so all signs point to the fact that Apple is going to unveil its long-awaited AI strategy at its upcoming Worldwide Developers Conference in June. Now, this conference is set to take place from June 10th to the 14th, and Apple has not revealed what it plans to announce related to AI, but it's clearly teeing this up and playing into the media frenzy around it. So Bloomberg actually reported that several people familiar with the matter say that Apple's kind of big presentation at the conference will focus heavily on AI. And Apple SVP of marketing, Greg Joswiak, posted on X this week, quote, "Mark your calendars for WWDC 24, June 10th to the 14th. It's going to be absolutely incredible." And he very, very intentionally capitalized the A and the I in absolutely incredible. Paul, we obviously don't have a ton to go on yet, but you're a longtime Apple watcher. Like, what would you expect to see or love to see at this event?
We've talked about the obvious plays, making Siri actually intelligent and functional and probably an agent of sorts where you can just say what you want and it's connected to all your apps and all your data already. And that could certainly lead to like an explosion in value creation through intelligent assistance. So Siri is the most obvious thing. other than that, it's a complete guessing game right now, because Tim Cook and Sundar Pichai, who, you know, CEO of Alphabet, were photographed having dinner together recently. They're having conversations with Google. They're probably having conversations with a lot of people. And so the question becomes, like, is Apple going to build their own foundation model, or are they just going to partner with Google like they did on search or maps? Apple has a history of not, of being a follower, of waiting around to see how things play out and partnering with other people in the meantime. So your iPhone had Google Maps long before it had a really powerful version of Apple Maps, but now Apple Maps is really good. So I think there's a lot of examples like that where Apple is very willing to be patient and partner with other tech companies to figure out what their long-term play is. And so it's possible we see something like that. Like, maybe Apple focuses on smaller models that can run on your phone, and they partner with someone like Google to do the bigger models, the larger foundation models. We have no idea, but I am going to block my calendar off on June 10th to hear what they have to say. And as an investor in Apple for a long time, I am very, very anxious to see what they do and try and sort of project around the corner a little bit if I think it's going to be received well by Wall Street, I would say.
So rumor has it that OpenAI is now taking meetings with Hollywood studios to convince them to use their new AI video generation model, Sora, in their work. Now, this is according to reporting from Bloomberg, which cited anonymous sources who are familiar with some of these discussions. Those sources also said these upcoming meetings are just the latest round of outreach from OpenAI. This actually comes right on the heels of a blog post that OpenAI published called Sora, First Impressions, which shows some stunning early short films being created by artists who got access to the tool through a program OpenAI was running. Now, Paul, we have covered a lot of AI tools and developments over the years. I've seen very few of them seem to have captured the imagination and cause concern like Sora is. I mean, I've heard about it from a lot of people in the marketing world, the agency world, the creative space. Everyone has a lot of opinions. Not all of them are great. I mean, is this like an effort by OpenAI, do we think, to manage and message like the disruption this tool is potentially going to cause?
Yeah, there's definitely a PR aspect to this, a very heavy PR aspect to this. I mean, that blog post you referenced about them with the like three or four, I mean, it's so blatantly just trying to put a positive spin on this.
Yeah.
There wasn't much depth to that. So, you know, I do think they're trying to play both sides here. They're trying to talk about it as like a creative tool that's going to enhance, you know, what creative people are capable of doing. But it's hard not to see the alternative side. And so I got, what part of me is like, isn't this what the Hollywood strike was all about? Was like not letting this stuff come into there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We don't know enough to really get deep and comment on it. But I mean, Sam specifically has said many times, including on the Lex Fridman podcast recently, they often preview technology to give society the time to prepare for it. And this certainly seems like a case of that, where they are putting this out there, they're showing the capabilities, and they are trying to prepare people for what this thing is going to be able to do. And I don't think we're seeing half of it yet. Like, my impression is that Sora is way more powerful and capable than we currently understand. And so I think people are rightfully concerned.
Yeah.
We're uncertain about what exactly this thing is going to be able to do, because all appearances are that it's going to have a significant impact on creativity and publishing businesses and media companies.
Yeah, I don't mean to be too skeptical or cynical, but putting my marketing and PR hat on, anytime I see something like this Sora blog post, I'm like, okay, we're trying to overcompensate. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's so blatant that it's cool. Like, there's cool examples, cool art being made. No doubt about that. It's awesome. People should check it out. But when you're calling out these huge quotes about how it's going to augment, not replace this type of art. I'm like, okay, we are
working
projecting
a little hard here. Yeah, it was not a two-sided blog post that did not address the concerns in the room. It was just everything's going to be sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah. All right. So Anthropic just got a nice boost to its bank account to the tune of $2.75 billion. This is because Amazon just completed the final round of $4 billion in funding that it committed to last year to fund Anthropic. Now, this is part of a kind of unusual funding deal that we reported on at the time. Amazon basically agreed to invest up to $4 billion in the company, and it appears they're exercising their option to do just that in this latest. Interestingly, at the same time, a huge stake in Anthropic worth more than $1 billion, or about 8% of the company, is up for sale because that stake is owned by the failed cryptocurrency exchange FTX, and it's being sold as part of that company's bankruptcy proceedings. One potential buyer of that stake has been turned down. CNBC is reporting that Anthropic reportedly has ruled out taking money from the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia that showed an interest in the stake over national security concerns. Anthropic isn't the only other big model company raising money. Cohere is as well. The information reports that the company is raising at least $500 million in a round that values Cohere at around $5 billion total. That round is being co-led by a Canadian pension fund called PSP Investments. Now, Paul, we talked a fair amount last week about Anthropic, Cohere, kind of the overall landscape of foundation models. Now, Anthropic appears to be a far healthier company from a financial perspective, but both are raising a fair amount of money. Like, what are the differences between these two companies? Like, what does this mean for the overall competitive landscape here?
You mentioned the Anthropic deal. So there's a Forbes article, and this is a little technicality, but just so people are familiar, again, it's not like Amazon just stepped up and did $2.5 billion, whatever. So the paragraph from Forbes says, Amazon's investment disclosed in a quarterly filing included a $1.25 billion deployed in September 2023 in the form of a convertible note that converts in this round. Convertible note is basically debt that converts into equity. Amazon also has an agreement, the company wrote, to invest up to $2.75 billion in a second note that would expire Q1 2024. A source with knowledge elaborated that either Anthropic and Amazon must decide on or before March 29th, the last business day of the first quarter, to trigger the larger second note, which would then convert into a future funding round. So that's what's happening here. And so again, the technicality, if you don't understand how convertible notes work, Amazon gives a loan for $2.75 million, whatever that number is. And if they don't choose to convert it into equity, then it's payable back as debt with principal and interest. So in essence, what happened is they had an agreement last year for up to $4 billion through these convertible notes. And within that, there's probably some sort of cloud compute, like, you know, versus not all cash, but they're basically just activating the note that they already had. That's kind of a technical way. The difference, I mean, Anthropic is certainly appears to be thriving and will remain a major player in this space, you know, trying to compete with OpenAI and Google and others. So I feel like they're a major player. Cohere seems to be really going much more toward the working directly with enterprises to build and tune custom models. They're not playing in the, it doesn't seem like, in the ChatGPT competitor game where you're going to like have Cohere up all day long, just testing it with, Anthropic and OpenAI's ChatGPT. But Cohere seems like they're going to do more through like distribution channels. And I think we talked about, or we'll talk about, like their deal with Accenture, where they're trying to basically work with the big consulting firms. And so the big consulting firms who have the relationships with the big enterprises would then basically bring Cohere in and build on Cohere. So that seems to be their model, is more of a distribution through existing consulting firms.
Gotcha. So we have another AI startup that's drawing some attention, this time due to the high profile of some of its investors. This company is called Asari AI, and it just launched with the backing of people like Eric Schmidt, the former CEO and executive chairman of Google. and Jeff Dean, who is the current chief scientist at Google DeepMind. So the company described its mission in a statement on X, and they wrote, "Building a new type of AI agent and tools that help us imagine and create 10x better solutions, products, and services that we can trust, including for applications that we might not have even thought of yet. To do so, our AI agents learn, reason, plan, and verify at scale. And we're reimagining how people can seamlessly collaborate and create with AI." Now, on their website, the company elaborates a little further, saying they're building intelligence to, quote, co-invent a future, quote, where people and powerful AI agents interact and collaborate in unseen ways to create and discover. And they emphasize again that we're building AI that plans, abstracts, verifies, and discovers new skills and knowledge. Now, Paul, we do not know a ton yet about this company. The people involved, though, are notable. The trend of companies building AI agents is notable. Like, can you talk a bit about why this company caught your eye?
So I've shared before, I have a AI tech watch list on Twitter. That's public list. We'll drop the link again in the show notes. There's 84 accounts that are tracked in there. Again, they're all tech companies, infrastructure, model, or application companies within the AI tech space. So the question I get a lot is like, well, how do you choose which vendors you're going to feature? You know, we've had PR people reach out and ask, can we pitch you on vendors? And my general response is, yeah, go ahead, but we probably won't cover them. The way that we figure out what matters or which ones to watch, it comes down to a few things. But in essence, we're trying to find the signal through the noise. And so the signal here is I get alerts from Jeff Dean and Eric Schmidt. Like on Twitter, I subscribe for notifications anytime they tweet. And so I do that with probably about 100 to 120 different people, researchers, entrepreneurs, investors, journalists. That's how I determine what matters. So a lot of the tech companies Mike and I talk about on this show, that's where it comes from. These aren't sponsors. These aren't people we're getting pitched on. This is pure like journalist work, I guess, research analyst work. Like we are just monitoring the space in real time. And so the way we decide what matters is who are the founders? Who are the investors? We track research paper writers. So if there's important research papers that have been written, like the attention is all you need paper, I track those eight people in real time all the time. So like when Jeff Dean, the chief scientist of Google and Google DeepMind, and Eric Schmidt, the former CMO, who's a major player in defense and intelligence in the US government right now, when they tweet the same company in the same 5-minute period, that gets through the noise. And so that's what happened here. Yeah, I know nothing about the company other than what Mike just shared, but they're on the AI tech watch list now because the two major investors are major former players, one former player of Google and one current player of Google. And that's what I would advise you all to do. Like you have, if you want to really stay on top of what's happening in the AI space, the only way to do it is to monitor the key players in real time. And that's hopefully what we do for you each week. Like that is basically what I spend my life doing, is monitoring all this stuff. And so that's how we determine which companies are worth talking about and which aren't, along with some other variables that we'll maybe get into at another time.
All right, our final news item for this week came in just before we started recording. Elon Musk and his company XAI have announced Grok 1.5, which is their latest AI model. They claim that Grok 1.5 can process long contexts up to 128,000 tokens, and that this model has displayed big improvements in coding and math tasks over the initial Grok model. Musk posted on X that Grok 1.5 should be available on X next week. And he also said Grok 2, quote, should exceed current AI on all metrics in training now. Paul, what were your initial thoughts of Grok 1.5?
So I woke up this morning, saw this tweet, and as I'm making coffee, I go into Grok and start playing around with it. Now, anyone who's listened to the show, I don't have a favorable impression of Grok up to this point, but I've always said just, I assume they'll figure this out, but Grok has been useless up until this point. So I go in and I said, what version of Grok are you? And it said, I am Grok version 2.0. And I was like, well, that's interesting. Next generation AI assistant built by XAI with inspiration from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Jarvis from Iron Man. My primary goal is to provide you with accurate, informative, and engaging responses to your questions and tasks. So then I said, what can you do differently or better than the previous version? So I'm assuming I now have at least 1.5, but maybe I do have two. I have no idea. So it says Grok 2.0 offers several improvements and enhancements over the previous version. Enhanced reasoning capabilities. It has the improved reasoning abilities, allowing it to provide more accurate and insightful answers to complex questions and problems. Increased context length, although it said it was only like 8,000 tokens, which I asked it about, and it was, I don't know. I thought it was supposed to be more. Custom training framework, real-time knowledge, better performance on benchmarks, and an increased focus on providing helpful and informative answers. So then I asked it, I was like, all right, let's get some real-time stuff. So I said, what happened in the Cleveland Guardians game last night? So the opening night for the Guardians was March 28th. They were at 10 p.m. Pacific time against Oakland Athletics. And it wrote what appeared to be an extremely accurate summary of that game. And it was almost like a news article summary. And I didn't even ask for that. So I was like, oh, okay, well, this is kind of different. Then I asked it, can you give me I asked it about Elon Musk's personality, like based on his tweets, and it did a pretty good job. And then I said, can you give me a summary of the last 10 tweets that at Paul Raitzer has shared? And it seemed to just like glitch, like it just stopped working. And I said, did you glitch? And nothing happened. And then I asked it another question and nothing happened. And I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. Like it seemed like we were onto something here. It was faster. It had real-time knowledge. It was not showing me Twitter cards, thank God, because it would surface like the most random Twitter users as representations of where its knowledge was coming from. So it seemed like we'd done away with that. And then it just stopped. And then I went back in and everything was gone again. And so this has been my experience with Grok to date is there's no conversation history. There's no way to like go see previous chats or threads. It all seems to just be a single thread, but that thread always just disappears. And so there's no way to keep track of any conversation you've previously had. So I don't know if I actually had a more advanced version for a moment, like they rolled something out and then they pulled it back. Because now when I go in, I can't do these things. And so I feel like I may have had 1.5 or 2 temporarily, but now I have usual Grok back and it seems to have all the normal issues. But my biggest one is it wipes away your history and you can't go back and look at like different conversations. So, and there's no search function. So if I had a conversation today, and a week from now, I wanted to go back and find the thing that it helped me do, I would have to just scroll through this thread in theory if the thread didn't erase itself. So I don't know. We'll wait and see. We'll see if it's getting better. It seems like the model itself is definitely improving. The user experience is still useless, in my opinion. Like you would not be using this instead of ChatGPT or Claude because it doesn't seem to be built for that. It's like, I don't know. So that's my take is it seems like we're heading in a direction of it being more useful, but I don't. They have to solve the user interface thing, and it's just it's not valuable until they do that. I'll keep testing it. I'll keep paying my $22 a month for all of you who don't want to pay the $22 a month and let you know what I learn.
That's what we're here for. All right, Paul. Before we go, two really quick announcements. First up, we have tons of people regularly who reach out and say how much they like the podcast, thank us for some of the work we're doing here. If you're one of those people, we have a favor to ask you. If you have found value in the podcast, could you please go rate the podcast and leave a review if possible? We'd love to start sharing further with new audiences through reviews, through ratings, how much everyone is enjoying the show. So please, on your podcast platform of choice, go ahead and leave us a really quick rating and a review if you can. Second, we say this every episode, but it is still there. The Marketing AI Institute newsletter, This Week in AI, is an extremely valuable weekly written brief to all the topics we discussed today with further analysis of those topics and all the things we don't have time to get to in each and every episode, which is often 6 to 12 to even more other topics of what's going on in AI. So if you have not signed up for the newsletter yet, please go ahead and do so. Go to marketingaiinstitute.com/newsletter
and check that out.
Paul, until next week, thank you so much for breaking down the crazy, wonderful, sometimes scary, but always interesting world of AI for us.
Yeah, thanks again to you, Mike, as always, doing a great job curating everything and leading the conversation. And anyone who is out celebrating spring break this week, have a wonderful time away. Hopefully, you know, if you're listening to this, it's all you're doing this week from a work perspective. So enjoy your time away with your friends and family. Be safe, and we will be back next week to do it all again. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for listening to The AI Show. Visit marketingaiinstitute.com to continue your AI learning journey and join more than 60,000 professionals and business leaders who have subscribed to the weekly newsletter, downloaded the AI blueprints, attended virtual and in-person events, taken our online AI courses, and engaged in the Slack community. Until next time, stay curious and explore AI.